Welcome you to today's session. NARPM presents Introduction to Near Surface Environmental Geophysics webinar. This is a practical guide for commonly used methods and applications. Your primary presenter today will be Jim Ercik, who is coming to you from EPA Region 5 in their Field Services Division. Jim is a geologist who began his career working for 10 years as a borehole logging supervisor and mine geologist at multiple underground mines in New Mexico. During the last 33 years, he has worked his way up the ladder, so to speak, at the EPA, where he has concentrated his time using direct push methods for sampling soil, water, and soil gas, as well as conducting and overseeing near-surface environmental geophysical surveys. His time here at EPA has been spent entirely within the Region 5 Superfund program in their field services section, working in conjunction with remedial project managers, on-scene coordinators, and brownfield project managers. During these years at EPA, Jim has acquired and maintained multiple surface and borehole geophysical tools for the region, and he's also designed and constructed environmental geophysical training suites for the EPA's environmental response training program. So with that information, let me go ahead and change the arrangement here so that you all can see Jim's presentation content. And I'll just confirm that, again, Jim, your slides are up on the screen. We can see it. And I will go ahead and let you formally begin with your presentation content whenever you're ready.
Great. Thank you, Jane. Greetings, and welcome to all of you who have made time to participate in this webinar. During the next hour and a half, we'll present several geophysical methods you've probably heard about that may have wanted to know more information about or how to apply these techniques. Our past environmental response training programs for environmental geophysical applications have consisted of classes ranging from 1, 2, and 3 days. This is the first time we are squeezing this way down to an hour and a half webinar format. So we have a lot to cover, so let's get started. This webinar is not intended to describe how to become a professional operator for these instruments, but rather how to learn how to recognize and apply these instruments to specific environmental problems correctly, and also what to look for when observing a survey to ensure data is being collected correctly. We're going to be keying in on how to request, plan, and review a geophysical survey. We will also provide information for avoiding interpretation pitfalls for reviewing a geophysical report. The term near-surface geophysics is distance below ground surface defined by the specific geophysical tools used to obtain answers to a problem dependent on its depth of investigation limit. For example, some tools have limited detection limit of 15 feet below the ground surface, and others to tens of feet. Other methods exist to detect deeper depths, but requires bulky equipment and acres of space to operate them. The types of near-surface targets we're going to be considering generally are just buried metal and other materials, either ferrous or non-ferrous metals. Knowing what types of equipment that were used to bury these materials is the first step in determining how deeply these may have been buried. Contaminant plumes are a little bit harder to find because their consistency has to be vastly different than the in-situ material. And it also has to be fairly thick. So contaminant plumes of a few inches versus a few feet are vastly different if we're going to detect them or not. We can also use geophysical methods to characterize layers of clay, sand, bedrock, soils, and voids. And we can also, in some cases, define areas where the groundwater is located. Now, what makes all these tools kind of unique is some of them use various physical properties, and that's what makes each of them so unique. So here's a list of several properties that our instruments use. Velocity, so what we're doing is measuring how fast a signal moves through the medium. Seismic methods uses acoustic sound waves. Radar method uses electromagnetic transmission. We have electrical impedance tools, how easy electric current would move through the medium, electromagnetics method and resistivity method. The magnetic methods and density and radioactive decay, these are all what we call passive methods. So we're just measuring what is there. So none of these instruments are transmitting any signals. It's basically just measuring what is around us or around the tool. So the magnetic method is actually measuring the strength of the magnetic field. Density is measuring the mass of below the instrument, and radioactive decay, our natural gamma, is just measuring the natural occurring gamma radiation, which is usually more significant in clays through the potassium that's in there. So the geophysical properties we can tie to specific tools. So the passive methods, magnetics, the tool that we use is called a magnetometer. Gravity, the instrument is called a gravimeter. The electric property is tied to electrical resistivity, where a current is injected into the ground and a voltage is recorded. The electromagnetic induction EM property refers to tools that create their own magnetic fields to detect within the limit of those fields. Now, there are two ways to measure within these fields: frequency domain and time domain. The frequency domain measures using radio frequencies that are either fixed or multiple frequencies at once. It's important to note that the lower frequencies can detect deeper and higher frequencies detect shallower. So we can actually kind of pinpoint, key in on certain depths when we're looking for materials. Now, unfortunately, the deeper you look, the less detail you're going to find. But if you're looking at shallower depths, you're going to have higher detail. The time domain measures by opening and closing electronic signal time gates, and this allows the time gates to split up the returning signals to isolate specific depth intervals. The EM radiation is radiating or transmitting electromagnetic waves. The GPR uses this method, where EM energy is broadcasted into the ground, similar to radar that we look for aircraft with. And acoustic energy is measuring reflections and refractions from sound source initiated at the surface. Another thing about these instruments, the newer ones, now they're all digital. Most of these instruments usually self-check themselves when you turn them on, so there's no need to calibrate. They're all pre-calibrated, and it will actually not work if it detects that there is a problem within its system. So that's kind of a nice feature versus the older instruments, where we actually had to send these off and get these calibrated. So let's take a look at some kind of targets that these tools are looking for. The magnetometer looks for anything that contains iron, such as drums, tanks, wells, foundations, and landfills. It can also measure fired clay, such as bricks, or any clays heated beyond the Curie point, which when cooled, the magnetic properties of the clay realign to match the natural magnetic field, thus increasing their ability to be detected. But that anomaly, which is produced from clays, is very weak. So archaeologists do use tools, but when they use it, they keep it really close to the ground. But as you see, when we'll show our equipment, we actually like to have it higher off the ground, so we're not getting a lot of the interference from anything on the surface. So electromagnetic conductivity tools have two components, the in-phase and quadrature phase. A very simplified explanation would be that the signal is split into two sets of information. One able to measure buried metal, that's ferrous or not ferrous, and another to measure ground conductivity. The tools listed on this slide usually require hundreds of feet of cable to use the tool, except for gravity. These lines are spread off across fields. To get deep enough, basically what we're looking for is bedrock or other changes in stratigraphy or contaminant plumes for electrical resistivity. Gravity we use for locating voids. The only case I know that was kind of different was where somebody was claimed that there was a tank below a what is now a grocery store. So in the evening they went to the store with a gravimeter and went down the aisles and were able to find the void, which was an empty tank below the concrete, and were able to pump it out and remove it. This is a slide which I'm very reluctant to share, since most of these depths are not like cut in stone. They're vastly different depending on the various conditions of the soil and of the material. But I do understand that some numbers have to be presented to generally frame the limits of these instruments. But just remember that these depths could be more or they could be less. But I can tell you that the EM 31 and 61 are unique in that they are basically limited in depths of 15 feet below ground level. Since I'm used to presenting this topic over a one-day time frame, I was wondering how I'm going to compress adequate information on each method into a short hour-and-a-half presentation. So my attempt to tackle this challenge is to capture the most important details for each method into one slide. They will include photographs of the tools in use. So as you observe these photographs, try to put yourself in the position of operator and ask yourself, is this something I can operate over my site? Each site is different, and only you have the best knowledge about your site. So keep in mind how the various tools would work under various site conditions. For example, wheeled carts would not be able to work in very high weeds or forested areas. Tools that are carried can access more difficult terrain. After we describe the different methods, we'll present how they request the review of survey, and we'll also present a few examples of the data collected. So what you see now is a gradient magnetometer. It detects only ferrous metals, so only items contain iron. So, and the whole reason why I'm showing these photographs is to kind of let you see if these tools can be tromped through a forested area or tall vegetation. So keep in mind how this might move through a site that you're debating to use the equipment. So the data logger is carried on a belt. It's real-time output on screen, so you can actually see the data as it's scrolling through. GPS is an option for this piece of equipment. Note that we have two sensors, and this is important that we'll talk about in a second. And they're both identical. Obviously, this is hand-carried, or you can mount it in a vehicle. It's normally carried 3 feet off the ground, but in certain cases, we can put this on a backpack and have these sensors higher off the ground if there is a lot of small surface pieces of metal that we're trying not to detect. Typically, it's used for depths between 0 and 40 feet. It's mass dependent. So if you have like 1,000 barrels really deep you're going to see past that 40 feet. But it's very odd, at least in my experience, to find that many barrels in one spot. But once again, it's mass dependent. They're passive sensors. They're only detecting the magnetic field of the Earth, so there's no transmission or reception of these sensors. When we write a report, it's going to show the data as a contour map or as a quasi-3D map, which is basically throwing a blanket over a contour map that has more colors. It's just another way of presentation for a contour map. The fanny pack is a belt that's strapped around your back that powers the unit. The black pipe that's hanging down on the end is just a brass counterweight for the sensors. And what you see now are these yellow ovals, which I call the penalty spheres. So I call it that because if you get the sensors around the little box on the left, there's a fence, a steel cyclone fence. So if you get your instrument in this area, you're going to be detecting that. So if you have above ground objects, you want to know where these are so you're not contaminating your data with something that you already know is there. And obviously, if you have a bigger steel object like a building, your penalty area is going to be much bigger. So this method can use one sensor, but I don't recommend it unless it's an emergency, such as when one of the two sensors fails. You will always see that these sensors are carried away from the body or the vehicle carrying the sensors. This is because the sensors are extremely sensitive and kept away from any metal on the operator or vehicle. I mentioned this before, both sensors are identical, so the goal here is to take readings at simultaneously having the sensors spaced 1 meter apart in a vertical plane. When an anomaly is found, the sensor closer to the ground will have a higher reading compared to the top sensor. The unit subtracts these readings and that's the anomaly value. So why do we have two sensors? Solar flares, believe it or not, can actually affect magnetic readings. Magnetic fields vary around the globe, stronger at the poles and weakest at the equator. Here in Chicago, background is about 65,000 gammas. Solar flares could either be minor or extremely high, short periods of time, or long periods of time. So using one sensor with a solar flare of 100 gammas will result in a background reading of 75,000 gammas. So how do we account for this using two sensors? Here's how it works. Measuring the background reading with two sensors will take a reading and subtract the values from the sensors, 65,000 here in Chicago. So subtract 65,000 from 65,000 and we get zero. But an anomaly of 1,000 gammas in the ground would be measured at 66,800 on the bottom sensor and 65,800 from the top sensor. The difference is 1,000. Add a solar flare of 10,000, two sensors will read 76,800, 75,800, and still a difference of 1,000. But that's only if you use one sensor. The reading will be 76,800. So you can get the idea of how easily using two sensors will just eliminate any influence from a solar flare. It's important that the operator keep the sensors the same distance off of the ground. Moving the sensor further or closer to ground while recording will influence the reading. The sensors are very fragile and can break easily. It costs about $800 a piece, but if you break one, they're sold as and calibrated as a set, so that would be $16,000. So a lot of times people mix up metal detectors with the magnetic method, and they're both different. Very important to remember this principle when you're requesting tools to find metal. Each will work, but each will have significant limitations. Metal detectors tend to have limited depth, where magnetometers can detect larger masses deeper, but only ferrous metal. So we're looking at a typical GPR setup. This is on a cart platform. What it does is take images of the subsurface, and we can use this to estimate depths to targets and confirm buried tanks by their shape. This instrument must have contact with the ground. It's usually hand-pushed or vehicle-towed. GPS is optional. Data logger stores the data. Real-time output on that screen. It uses EM electromagnetic energy and battery power. And the battery is down here by the wheel. The antenna contains a transmitter and a receiver. And the antenna size shows its frequency. So we can select antennas with different frequencies to look shallower or deeper in the ground. So the higher the frequencies, the shallower, and the bigger the antenna, the deeper it will look. It's important to note that this cart can be used for several different sizes. So there's actually pins that hold this together that can be taken out and fitted to smaller or bigger antennas. So here's what I call the penalty box for the radar. It looks like it's pretty small for having interference, which it is, but quite commonly people stake flags or wooden posts to mark their grids. So if this tool is this close to a flag or a stake, it will be, the signal will reflect off of that. Even if somebody is standing right here, that will reflect back into the antenna and that will ruin your data. So when you're using this thing, if there are stakes or flags out in the field, try to keep about 6 inches to a foot away from these, or as your contractor is keeping that kind of distance away from these so they're not messing up the data. So the depth of investigation for this tool is typically 0 to 30 feet. So we can have reports showing the data usually as a single cross-section, or if we have multiple runs very close to each other, you can actually have this in 3D. So besides the lat long to locate your data, there is a wheel encoder on this that will tell you how many feet you will have down the lines that you're going through. This can't go over large twigs or branches without breaking contact and won't be very useful. Another thing to note is that data will look different if you're moving from a dirt road to a paved parking lot. And the reason would be that there's usually less moisture underneath the parking lot, and that means that you can see deeper, because when soil is saturated, it's absorbing more of the GPR signal, and you won't go as deep. And another thing to note is that angular cobbles that might be at a surface will scatter the signals. This instrument can detect some plumes also, and that is through a method which we call pull-up, which we'll show you in a few more slides. This instrument here is electromagnet, well, it's EM31, which is a fixed frequency domain tool. The important thing to note here is this photograph was taken of the instrument lengthwise, perpendicular to where it, the route you would actually walk with it, only for easier demonstration with these photographs. So it's used to determine the ground conductivity, look for plumes, and ferrous and non-ferrous metal detection. It is hand-carried, or it can be towed with the vehicle. GPS is optional. It uses electromagnetic energy and through battery power. The transmitter and receiver are on each end, and it takes two readings at once. It takes the quadrature phase, which is the ground conductivity reading, and it takes the metal detection in phase reading. Once again, it's fixed frequency, which means it's only looking at one depth. Well, actually, we're averaging everything in that frequency. The data logger stores the data. We have real-time output on the screen. Now, the coil angle sets the depth limit. So right now, the way this is being held in the first picture is in vertical mode. So the vertical mode is looking the deepest. So it's looking at this circle that has the greatest circumference. Now, the nice thing about this tool is that if we rotate it 90 degrees, so right now the screen that this operator is looking at is right here. So if we turn it 90 degrees, either toward him or away from him, it reduces its depth of exploration to this area. And what's nice about that is if you have an anomaly and it's down here and then you rotate it to a horizontal angle and you get a background reading, you know that the anomaly will be deep and not shallow. And the way we display this data is usually on contour maps. It's very important to keep the boom parallel to the ground. Bringing them closer or further from the ground will interfere with the reading. So if you're going uphill, you would actually have the boom parallel to the angle of where you're walking. The GEM2 is another electromagnetic tool, but it's a newer tool, and it's able to use multi-frequencies, once again, to detect ground conductivity and metal, ferrous and non-ferrous metal. It is hand-carried or vehicle towed. Data logger stores the data. Can take multiple readings. So multiple frequencies mean we can look at multiple depths. GPS is optional. We still have the quad phase and in phase for the metal detection and ground conductivity, but we lose the option to turn this sideways to look shallower. This instrument is not built to run in with that option. This photograph that you see is an older GEM2. It can display data, but it scrolls so slowly because you're looking at, we usually set five set frequencies in here. So looking at 12 frequencies as you're walking at a pretty good pace, it's kind of worthless to view the data because it's not scrolling fast enough. But I believe the newer models have a graphic output that compensates for that. This tool has three antennas, a transmitter and a receiver at each end, and what we call a bucking antenna for disseminating the signal that's between the two. Once again, he uses electromagnetic energy and under battery power. And as I said, we usually use between 5 and 6. This will actually take up to 30 frequencies, but looking at that many drains the battery quicker, and the data interpolation with 30, well, actually 60, because we're looking at both the quad and in-phase information. It would significantly increase the time to analyze that data. So, since we do have so much data, we can actually plot in 3D, but typically we use contour map. So the area of surface interference is either 15 feet ahead or behind it. So the images at the bottom are kind of showing how this works, pulse frequencies into the ground. So when you're actually plotting the data, you're actually looking at the intervals at these green stripes. One more thing about the GEM and EM31. These instruments will record different readings near surface after a rain event. So data over the same area before and after significant rain will not match. So I typically include a weather underground summary of the weather and rain reports when these instruments are used, so that if anybody looking at the data will have a reference to why the data may have changed, and that was due to rain. This instrument here is the high-sensitivity metal detector. We show an older unit and a newer unit. It can be pushed or pulled or towed by a vehicle. GPS is optional. The older unit has a backpack and a controller. The data logger is on the handle, where the newer model, all electronics are either here or here, so you don't have to carry a backpack. Real-time on-screen output uses electromagnetic energy. We have three antennas, two that are in the lower triangle here, and one on the top triangle. So we have two transmitters and one receiver. So transmitter, and receiver is down here. Coil allow us, since we have two of them, want to look shallow and deep, so we actually can split out the data to look deeper and shallower, but is limited to a depth of about 15 feet. And our report usually comes with a contour map. One of the bad things about this instrument, it's looking not only 15 feet below the ground surface, it's actually looking 15 feet above the ground surface. So if you're in a building where you have metal within 15 feet near the ceiling, you're going to be picking up that information. So previous instruments just presented would not work inside buildings except GPR. But this instrument could work provided nothing is within 15 feet from the ceiling that is metal. The nice thing about this instrument, since the horizontal area of detection is so limited, it can be used to outline shapes of anomalies, such as a tank. So if we find an anomaly, we can keep running back and forth to find the limits, and what we usually do is use spray chalk to actually outline the anomaly itself. And there is a wheel encoder on this system that will keep track of your There is a problem that I've seen from people, novice operators, Somebody may have staked out a grid using metal pin play, and the operator would be taking this right down the center of the pin flags. And if they're metal, that's going to be a problem, because every time they hit a pin flag, it's going to be spiking the data. So it's always a good rule of thumb that if you ever have to use pin flags when you're setting up a grid, is to use plastic pin flags. Here's a method that isn't used too often because it requires so much space. Direct current resistivity. So what we're doing here is trying to detect subsurface conductivities, such as looking for bedrock or plumes. So we have a long line, which we call the resistivity array, which is a bunch of electrodes all connected together. The system is battery powered. More sophisticated units are pre-programmed with internal switching. Literally, you set this stuff up, go have yourself a cup of coffee, and come back in a couple hours, and all the data would be collected. Quite often, these lines are duplicated, offset from each other to get more detail. You can look up to 1,000 feet. 100 feet or more, depending on cable length, the adequate DC power that you have powering it, and more resistive materials will limit the depth. If you have a lot of elevation changes along this line, you could have them surveyed to adjust for the resultant data so it matches the surface in the ground. We use tape measures to lay out the lines. Electrodes are just big, long nails that we pound into the ground and hook up. This particular unit here is called a sting. It's the controller and processor and the cabling. So, as you can see, it's not optimal in congested areas. We have this photo shows it's actually going across the road, which can cause problems. And you really don't want somebody coming up and touching these electrodes. So another method is the seismic refraction method. It's commonly used to define bedrock or other stratigraphy that may be in the area and groundwater. So what this method, how this works is we're striking a hammer on a metal plate and creating a pressure wave, a primary wave, and using that record to make our picks. And I'll show you an example of that in a few more slides. So what we're doing, we're recording the first refracted energy from the subsurface. We can use it to find groundwater, bedrock, and weathered zones. Here's a close-up. So it's basically a spike. What we use our foot to kick this into the ground to have good contact. We have the sound source. And on this sound source is a little trigger. So when this hammer hits the plate, this trigger will tell the instrument, start recording for the next few nanoseconds while the sound is traveling through the ground. And the geophones, as you see here and here, will be picking up the refracted sound. So it's sensitive to external noise, so if there's cars or people walking near these phones, that will interrupt the signal that we're trying to get, trains, and also trees. If it's a very windy day, the movement of the leaves and will actually transmit down to the roots and be picked up by the geophones. So all this information is collected on a laptop with a special program. It takes a shot of the data. Once again, not optimal in congested areas because some of these lines can be from 50 to 100 feet or more in length. And what we've seen the display of data is what we call a seismic record. So microgravimeter, so this is the instrument that measures material density void. This must have strong, stable contact with the ground. It's very time intensive since what we're measuring is so small. It uses a spring that has a weight on it, and the spring has to settle down after it's transported to the ground, and also has to be temperature climatized before it put into use. Very susceptible to vibration also and wind. The unit does store its data. It's battery powered. Can see the data on screen. Once again, this is a passive sensor. There is nothing transmitted or received. And the data is plotted out on a contour map. The better units are internally correct for tide, since that will influence gravity based on its location. So you have to know your lat long. And the depth of the investigation depends on mass. So the readings are non-unique. So if you have a void, the reading is going to be less here than if there was no void. So all you're doing is making comparisons of each reading as you take them. So we're just going to touch just for a few minutes on borehole geophysical methods. I will give you the name of another person who has a clue-in webinar for the more sophisticated borehole methods, but what wasn't covered in that I'm trying to cover here, which is how to deal with existing 2-inch modern wells. There are times where we receive legacy wells, so that's from a site that has been taken into federal intervention through whatever problems that have occurred, and we have no information on these wells. It could have been an abandoned facility, so how can you get some information about wells you have no information about? So, and the other circumstance that you can want to know more about a 2-inch modern well is for your 5-year reviews. I'll have some pictures at the end of the presentation of how some of the wells look that were kind of neglected after 5 and 10 years, and I highly recommend that if you have these reviews, actually go out in the field and take a look, because a lot can happen to these things in that amount of time. So specifically, we're going to just be touching on the optical camera, natural gamma tool, and the ground conductivity tool. Just a word about modeling. I typically don't use this. I do a lot of work on removal sites, and what's nice about removal sites is that if you find an anomaly, they usually have a backhoe around that can dig it up. But just a brief reminder what these forward and inverse models are. Forward models are models in which conditions are defined and the data set is calculated. These are very helpful to see if a particular method will work for the terrain. conditions and other targets that is expected. Basically, a forward model will tell you if you can see a distance, see a difference in the data set between a given target. Inverse models are models that take field data and use it, and usually in an iterative process to come up with an interpretation that fits the data. These are always non-unique and depend heavily upon input conditions and pre-model setup. So if you don't know what you have, it's kind of difficult to model. But basically, you're just guessing anyway. So such guesses on depth and thickness and layers and resistivity models, for example. And it's important to note that models are not reality. Once again, you're just taking a guess. So the advantage of geophysical methods is that they're non-intrusive, obviously except for the borehole methods. Rapid data collection. We just finished a 76-acre site last month, and we did that in 5.5 days just using the JUMP. So that was quite an amount of space in a relatively short time. And it's also used to fill in data gaps. The limitations are that the methods require a specialist to be looking at this. Often these contour maps are kind of obvious with their colors and anomaly areas that you either have them or you don't, but there are certain times where you would have an anomaly that's one that you're not really looking for, so it's important to have a specialist that can tell you that, yes, this anomaly is real and it's not something that you should, or if it is something that you should just ignore. The important limitation is that physical contrast must exist between the target and the in-situ material. If that's not there, none of these tools are going to be able to help you. And the resolution varies by the method and the depth of the target. If it's really deep, some of these may not work. Most of these tools are pretty expensive, and having a professional operate these are also costly. And most of the time, the actual report is optional, so there is another expense if you want to have a report. Once again, all these interpretations are non-unique. So what do I mean by that? Here's a little cartoon of somebody with a magnetometer finding an anomaly and taking a guess at what it is. Problem is that it could be something that you're not expecting, just a landfill with a bunch of metal. So this is actually a real-life situation that happened last month. We found an anomaly, which we thought was buried drums, and it turned out to be buried seatbelt buckles from a metal working shop. So let's now change gears. Is there any questions right now? Okay, if not.
Oh, sorry, Jim, we do have some questions, but I think just in the interest of time, I just wanted to do a time check for you. It's 1:53 p.m. right now, so maybe it might be better to just keep going with the materials, and we'll pause for questions later.
Okay. All right, so let's work on setting up a geophysical survey for a specific problem. Here's a 30-acre site. Let's say we've heard from several witnesses that 100 drums were leaking toxic chemicals buried at the site. How we try to locate these are dependent on several factors. Are they buried together, spread out over the whole site? How deep are they? What kind of drums, plastic, metal? Will geology, hydrology play a role? How will vegetation and topography cultural experience affect this? So we can see from the photograph, we do have some vegetation. It's hard to see, but there is a valley to the southwest. So if we do have any plume migration, it's probably going down here because there is a stream down here, and the shadow here is a high-power tension line. So we're going to hire a contractor to look at this whole area. Are they going to be using all these methods, or conversely, is the contractor specialist in one particular method, and is he only or her going to use that method? So if we have 100 drums scattered throughout this site, and if you did some research, you will know that this once was a 60-foot deep quarry that was filled in as a landfill. So if these 100 drums were scattered throughout this landfill, I can tell you no, you won't be able to find those due to the other masses of metal that is in here. So to create a survey rationale, it's obvious to have a plan to get started. We want to avoid issues of property line, archaeological sites, utility lines. And not utility lines in the sense that we want to know where they are so we don't ever dig them up, but utility lines can cause noise problems. Some of these instruments can detect some of these lines, so you need to know where they are. So basically what we need to know is that every site is a custom problem and detailed to the specifics of that site. This is rather a common sense slide. It's basically that we're applying common sense when we're making a plan. We're taking the time to do it right. So first thing we want to do is define the problem. You know, what are you doing? You're looking for drums. You're looking for a place to sample around an area which you think is contaminated. Can geophysics help? Once again, with this quarry. You're looking for 100 drums scattered throughout 30 acres, no, geophysics won't help. So the other item to ask is the data confirmable? Will it result in the benefit in what you are looking for? So some of the background paperwork you want to look at is the site history, previous studies, if any were done by maybe a state or county, know the geology of the area, the hydrology of the area, geographic issues such as elevation changes, forested areas. Will you need to work in level B if this area is so contaminated, and also flap issues? So you also want to be looking, including some background maps and images. We'll talk about Sanborn maps in the next slide. Topographic maps, once again, will provide areas that are forested, elevation changes. Geologic maps will tell you the bedrock, depth to bedrock, the elevations of the bedrock, and what types. So if you have a Dean Apple, bedrock geology may have an influence on where that plume goes, and also aerial images. So Sanborn maps were created to allow fire insurance companies to assess properties. It started in 1867 and ended in 1977, but these maps are still available. And I apologize for not having one directly related to a manufacturing facility, but these are copyrighted and cost money to obtain, and I was lucky enough to be able to grab this one off of an example. So the point I'm trying to make here, I mean, you can see that there's meat lockers, kitchen, billiard room of this hotel and dining room. So the point I'm trying to make is that if you have a plan view of a building from 1907 describing what each room was room for, used for, codes for building height, material height, water lines, basically everything you wanted to know in a neighborhood. So these can be helpful. Topographic map, it seems rather innocuous all by itself, but it can tell you a lot of information. So let's for example, this area is our site. So the green areas show that where the forest is, and we're not seeing a lot of it there. The elevation is fairly flat. Here is a circle with a dot in it. And for those of you who don't know what that symbol is, that's a tower, and most likely a radio tower. So that might cause influence because you're emanating electromagnetic fields when you use broadcasting towers, and that's going to influence some of our instruments. We see railroad lines. We see highways. So right away you can tell you won't be able to use seismic methods. Through past experience, I've noted where junior high schools are and high schools, because if we had to stake this with stakes and left them overnight with children walking past this, there are chances that these might be pulled up or rearranged, so just something to be aware of. So if there is any groundwater contamination, there is a stream here, so we can expect the direction of groundwater flow. So once again, a lot can be gleaned off the topographic map. And here is a map of the geologic map showing the elevations of the bedrock. So this is a photograph of the previous site. Here's that site we talked about. If you look very carefully, you can see the shadow of this broadcasting tower. We can also see power lines right here and a high voltage line. So if we're doing electromagnetic measurements at this site, I doubt if this high voltage line would be a problem, but definitely the power lines right here would be a problem. Background photos. Here we have a site that they built pumps, the pump handles for gas pumps at this factory. This is the headquarters, and this caught fire. And the reason that's significant is when you have fire, they're usually pouring a lot of water on it. So by seeing this photograph, we can assume that there's a chance of contamination getting into the groundwater from all the firefighting. Or possibly internal tanks bursting and releasing its contents. So these photographs below, this is a training site that we have in Palos Hills, Illinois. A college gave us this whole property here. So to show that we practice what we preach, we did our photographic interpretation and found that there was some scarring here, and we decided not to touch that area since we don't know what that was. So we limited our test site to just this area here. The agency has the ability to obtain historical photos and actually have them photo interpreted. I know it's hard to see, but I couldn't find a better example. This is a photo from 1936, which it was just farmland. The outline of the site here, and they delineated all of the flow patterns for the surface water. This is the color infrared with the site layout. This is a river here, stressed vegetation. This river must have flooded recently and stress the vegetation. What you can note here our solid waste piles, truck dumping areas, stained soil, and fly ash. This is from 1981, and currently how the site has changed. So the contact for EPA personnel is Tim Richards, if you want to request this. So what they do is they take all the historical photographs and overlay Mylar interpretations all penned out over these. And there's multiple overlays to segregate the kind of topics and issues you want to use. But the bad thing is it takes 3 to 6 months and it's very expensive to use this method. So other things to consider when you're planning a survey: property boundaries, consent for access, traffic. I used to just have traffic, but I had somebody throwing rocks at us at one time, so I've added pedestrians to the things to consider. Vegetation status is very important. Noise issues with the instruments, utility location, archaeological sites. So if you run into an area that has archaeological consequences, here's some guy collecting bones of dead bodies for some reason. But anyway, if you run into anything like this, it needs to be reported, and the agency will send somebody to investigate it. This is an important thing to note if you're dealing with hazardous waste and containers. The whole idea here is the intention to reduce chances of digging into containers of hazardous waste, which could release waste into an environment, or having containers blow up if they're shock sensitive or commingling of non-compatible waste. So this law was created to kind of mitigate that problem. So what kind of questions you need to know up front: what is the area to be surveyed, size and number of targets and depth, other problems, is the site reconnaissance needed? Well, in these days of low budgets, site reconnaissance is usually not part of the issue. So they often request that, how we get around that is asking for photographs. So there was a site where we had a planning commission in the Upper Peninsula for brownfields requested our help, and I said, sure, send us photographs. So here we have a facility that is getting a service for free, and so they're going to send me the best photo they have of their site, and this was it. So this is the next best thing to a soccer field for doing a survey. But it turned out in reality, this is what it looked like when we were doing the survey. And here we are doing a magnetic survey in tall weeds. And at the other end of the site is a bunch of rocks. And then they requested, they really needed to get in here to get some data, and I just couldn't do it. These are 6-foot cockle burrs, which I refused to go through, so they were able to get a backhoe to fix that problem. So once again, what our goal is to match what matches, contrast mold from background. Can the instrument operate over the terrain, through the weeds, and know the depth limitations of the instrument versus the target. So I mentioned noise several times, so what I'm talking about is things that are going to interrupt and interfere with the instruments. So those are the penalty areas I was telling you about. So what we need to know is the penalty area. So what we usually do is apply a walkaway test. So we start at the source and walk away until the reading normalizes, and then that's the distance we know to stay away from the target. So here's a graphic showing what I mean by having contrast between the target and the source. So let's say this yellow area is a bunch of drums buried in the ground. So that is a high contrast target. So So let's say over here we have maybe a thin, filmy plume that is just very thin and very meniscus in this one particular area that is not having a lot of contrast between the conductivity of the plume or the ground. So it's going to be very difficult or impossible to see. So what our goal is to match the method, the correct method to the target that we're making the assumption. So if metal is a part of the target element, we need to know if it's ferrous or non-ferrous to know what instrument to use. Is geologic structure critical to the element, the location of bedrock and clays, or do we need to know if it's a permeable formation? Contaminants, do we know if it's a high or low conductivity plume? We need to know where groundwater location is. Are we trying to find landfill boundaries or voids? So once we do select a method, what are the limitations we're going to face? If we're in an area that has a lot of rebar above the surface and we're looking for very limited drums, this is going to interfere with our survey. So, collecting data. We usually like to collect data in some kind of grid traversing special routes at special distances in between the grids to collect the data. So the spacing of these grids is going to be dependent on target size. Then we need to maintain this accurate pattern and line establishment. So we usually use GPS or tapes, ropes, or other method to keep us online. And that we do that to ensure location accuracy. So it's always good to take good notes and plenty of photographs. So when we say grid, technically, when people mention grid, it's just taking readings at equal distances. But back in the 70s and 80s, we actually did have to use that. The instruments took several seconds to take a reading, so you take a reading and go to the next spot. But nowadays, everything is digitized. So what we mean by grids nowadays is actually we're taking a whole bunch of readings constantly in one line, moving over and then doing it again. So the analogy of establishing a grid is like the pixels in a photograph for the data density. If you don't have a lot of pixels in a photograph, you can't tell what it is. So the more pixels, the tighter the grid, the more likely it is you're going to be able to find out what your target is. So detection probability, for example, this green box here is approximately an acre, so that's approximately 200 feet by 200 feet as an example for an area. So let's say you have a target that's has an area of 4,356 feet, and the area of the site is 43,560 feet. The probability of detecting that would only require 16 measurements. So the smaller the target, the more readings you're going to have to take. So the whole thing is here, you don't want to set a standard grid problem or spacing for a survey. You want to match the target sampling grid, the amount of samples you take to the size of the target, so you're not wasting time or money. This is a back-of-the-envelope calculation that if you want to check a contractor to see if you're lucky enough to know the size of your target in reference to your sight to use. From what I understand, this is being recorded, so if you wanted to have this in the future, you can go back and take a look at this. So I always use the 100% probability factor in this formula. So typical grid traverses, there's several. The alternating mode, which is most often used, we call that the lawnmower mode. Random mode, used for small areas, mostly, and the parallel mode, used for irregular shapes. So what we do is we break these into rectangular shapes or multiple baselines, and depending on the data logger we have, how that is collected. So here's a random survey road, for example, in a small backyard. We're just beginning and kind of walking around collecting data. So we would actually note this pattern since we're not using lat longs to establish how this data was collected. So here's the alternating traverse where we're just going back and forth. This is called lawnmower mode. So if you have obstructions where you can't have a perfect grid, this is how you would deal with it. You'd have a baseline, and you would take data in one direction, walk back, and take it again to have sequential data if you're not using a GPS. So if you have a site and you don't have GPS and you want to set up your own grid, let's say the area is this blue box, we set up flags. I usually alternate flags, colors, so you're not getting confused. And as you walk by these, I usually pull these out, and these red markers are the flags. So actually, this is setting up to do a lawnmower grid. So the data recorder has several ways of collecting data. It's either by distance, time, the encoder wheel on the instrument, or GPS. Time devices, the GEM-2 has a time device which is actually sends out a pulse beep to actually have you match your pace to this beep as it's collecting data. And very important that if you come to an obstacle, the data is still going to be recording, so to stop that, you would hit the pause key until you walk around or over the obstacle and to continue your survey. If you're using a GPS device, it's important to have a proper datum, projections, and units, and correcting for errors. Wheel encoders, every once in a while, those need to be calibrated to maintain the distance. So here's the common problem you have with the GEM, for example, if you're not using GPS and you're using that time method. So if you have an even pace, the instrument is going to collect the data in this manner. But if you're off pace, if you have to climb over something and then subconsciously you want to make up for that in your mind, so your pace kind of steps up. So if you don't hit the pause here to compensate for this change in pace, your data is going to look like this. And when it's processed after you end your line, so your data is not going to be taken in the locations that you expected. It's just important to note that there's various types of global positioning systems. Some at a large scale, some on a small scale, so be aware of that. There are several tools out there for GPS. Standalone receiver, which is usually the recreational units. Differential correction, which is a system where we're actually using a private vendor to assist the signals that are already out there. You can also post-process. There's RTK survey grade, which is real-time kinematic, which kind of integrates satellites with the ground-based stations. And here are the accuracies of these methods. If you use a cell phone, you're only getting about 80 feet plus or minus on that location. Currently, in Region 5, we use differential correction. So how this works is these four satellites are out there free to the public, and this is a vendor who has their own satellite. So I think we pay $880 for this service a year. So this is an operator collecting some information. So the vendor has stations all throughout the U.S. that they know exactly where they are at, and they integrate all these information from the three satellites and these other stations to correct and actually send you a corrected station location, which is submeter. Most of these geophysical instruments will connect and integrate to GPS systems. If you want to traverse specific routes, there's two possible options. Trimble has a system called a parallel swathing system, and the agency has access to FAST, which is the Field Analysis and Sampling Tool. Unfortunately, it's a system that hasn't been upgraded, so you would need a Windows XP operating system. It's available to EPA staff. It requires a non-EPA image laptop. So what you do is pre-survey, lay out your survey ahead of time before you go in the field, and then turn on the system in the field, and the operator will follow the breadcrumbs to take you over the area you want to scan. The Trimble system uses a light bar. So you establish your baseline, beginning and ending points, and tell it how far you want to offset each time, and it will tell you what line you are on. It will show if you're offline, it will have red lights going off to the site where you need to correct for, and when you're at the end of the line, these lights on the end will turn red to tell you to turn around and return to your other direction. So how do you apply these methods? Well, it's generally you want to use an instrument that has a large sensing area and rapid collection time. And then secondly, you want to have an instrument that has more defined sensing capabilities, such as GPR or the EM61. So here's the checklist. If you're considering a geophysical survey, define the problem, research the history. Are you trying to find area of concern, note site condition, targets, estimate depth. Here's the main question, will it help at all? And try to find the methods that have the most contrast. So when you're requesting a geophysical survey, use a source that's knowledgeable about all methods. You don't want somebody who is, well, I'm an expert in magnetics, so that's all I'm going to use, because that might not be the issue at all, and maybe you're looking for a contaminant plume. If you have to write a contract, put in what ifs. You know, what if I have to go to level B? What if I have to get a bulldozer to mow down some cockle burrs? What if it rains so hard that it floods? Just things like that. Keep an open mind to other issues. Always get raw data and notebooks from the contractor of all the data, and be aware that the interpretation may be a separate report. So let's get into some examples. This is mag data from a rubble fill in Waukesha, Wisconsin. We did this on an ATV. This is roughly 900 feet from top to bottom, and I think we did a 10-foot grid. So there's a church over here and a parking lot, and this is a soccer field, which is owned by the city, and this is the city's parking lot and a running path that goes through here. So the dark lines are the traverses we made with the magnetometer. So that's a 10-foot grid. The circles, this is a neat little trick that I've learned through the past use of using these tools. When you're using GPS and you see a something on the surface that you know is metal that's going to affect your readings, I make a circle around it. So not only are you putting this in your notes, but the GPS is actually flagging those areas. And these happen to be soccer nets that we were going around. So we knew that if we had any anomalies around here. So it's very faint to see, but the yellow and the blue colors are the contour intervals for the magnetometer. So you can see there's a lot of anomalies here. This big one was a monitoring well, we believe. So here's an important thing to remember when you're overseeing sites. So you can see here, this is what a 10-foot interval looks like. So let's say a PRP who said, you know, this is a big site. We only want to do 50-foot intervals, and we're only going to start on this right side here and move to the west. So if that was done, you're probably going to miss the well. You're going to completely miss all this down here. And what this actually turned out to be, the company that was using this as a rubble fill actually donated this land to the church, and this is where they buried their hazardous waste. This site is actually just north of this site. There was a road that splits these. I've never seen a road going in between two landfills, but we had it here. So here we have some more anomalies, and this was sold to a developer to put in apartments over a landfill. So naturally, over the years, the foundation started to crack, and the county had to come in and condemn the area, and they just bulldozed everything into the basement and covered it up. Here's an example from EM31 in Toronto. So here's some contour data of the apparent conductivity, which is the ground conductivity. So what we're looking for are like circles and lines, because in nature, circles and lines are kind of not too prevalent. So you can see something here, lines here. There is another way to look at this. We're using a shaded relief contour map, and this is looking at the metal. So if you kind of compare these two, you can kind of see the pipes more clearly in the quad phase in the circle there. So, and what this turned out to be was some storage tanks where they just cut off and covered over. So that was kind of an interesting sight. This is the GEM-2. This is the instrument that you can program in frequencies to look at different depths. So we program surface 10, 15, 20, 23 feet. This is at one of our test pit facilities in Ohio. So this is magnetic susceptibility. So this is the metal detection phase. So this is a road that is right here with a bunch of buried utilities underground. This is a well, which you can see all the way through to 30 feet. And I'm not going to give away the clues for these other targets since we do use this for training, but you can actually see, you can see it from 0 to 10, and then we start to lose that. And this is the ground conductivity. So there's changes in the ground conductivity either to some kind of plume or other types of soil changes that you can see. So it's more in this 10-foot level, it's more than you can see at surface, and it dissipates as you go further down. Direct push soil connectivity, this is kind of in the borehole method, but it's what we have a tool with four electrodes on it that we use a geoprobe to push into the soil. We had a request from the city to look for salt plumes in this around this abandoned oil field, and we actually did find that this is corrected for elevation. So you could see the salt plumes more conductive, and we did pick that up with this tool. This is the EM61 where we have a metal detector. As you can see, there's three buried tanks right here. Probably a filling station for the fuel here and pipes going, electrical and other pipes going into the building for services. This is a EM61 at an abandoned Coast Guard station near Hancock, Michigan. It's kind of hard to see this, but the light gray is, once again, the ATV doing the, making traverses over the site. The boathouse is here. This is trees. These are water pipes from the facility. This was a boathouse on the canal that was right here. So what they were concerned about was looking for old burn pits from years ago, and that's what all these anomalies here were, just the old cans and other refuse that they put in their burn pits. Here's some GPR looking at five tanks. You can see where the beds of the tanks were laying. So if you run over the rounded edges of tanks, GPR will give you this hyperbola looking feature. And if you time slice this, it has to be post-processed to look at these, but you can time slice it to see what it looks like at different depths. If you do a real tight spacing, you can use 3D. This is a 30 meter by 6 meter area at a depth from 6 to 8 meters. Mostly sand and gravel. GPR works great in sand, less in clays. So you can see the water tables, it sticks out pretty good. Gravel lenses, and for the bedrock, you can actually see that it's tilted bedrock, and that shows up very well. This is a leaking tank that a contractor years ago did a GPR survey around here and missed this target. I don't know if maybe a car was parked here since this was a parking lot. I don't know how it happened, but when we ran this line here closest to the building, this is the spine of the tank, so this is what we call the back. So that showed up very well. These are pipes that are going from the road into the building, and we think this is another one here. So this line from C to D is perpendicular to this one, so you can see the rounded tank here. And we lose our signal. I mean, you usually lose signals in contaminant plumes and kind of washes out the signal. So not only do we know that there is a tank there, but it is currently leaking. This is another site. It's in a glaciated area with sand and a lot of gravel. And we lost our signal here, and we actually saw stained soil here, and we asked the owner, so why is this soil stained? And he said, well, that's where I throw my water softener out, the water when he cleans out his water softener. So that's actually just a big salt plume, so the GPR picked that up very well. GPR has a post-processing function where you can use other color options, and when you use that, you can actually highlight anomalies that you see in the standard default mode. So if you ever get GPR data and you get something that you don't see a lot of detail, please ask for other color options to kind of make that stand out. So here's some example of a seismic shot. This is where we make a sound wave at the surface, and we have geophones here all along here to collect the data. So this is what it looks like on the computer screen. So if we plot the first arrival at all the geophones on a graph, we get, this is an example of a three layer. So you have the first layer here, the second layer, and the third layer. So these are all of different compositions. The velocities are different. So that's, and we can actually put, make calculations on these angles to see the speed that the acoustic velocity is going through these different layers. Here's a resistivity example. We have the voltage going into the ground. We have our electrodes out here. So you always get this type of V pattern, and that's just the way the data is collected. So you can see that this area here is more conductive than at the surface.
Jim, before you go any further, just a quick time check. We've got about 25 minutes or so left in our time slot right now.
Okay, I think we're going to work out just fine. So here's an example for, it's always a good idea to confirm your anomalies, and this is basically a fairly standard way of doing it, using magnetics for rapid data collection, EM to get more detailed dimensions, and GPR to actually get the depth of the target. So when you're requesting a survey, if you're having a contractor, this is what they should ask you. How big is the site? What kind of targets do you have? Orientation, size, depth of burial if known, type of terrain, site conditions, and special circumstances if they have to work in special protective clothing. Provider submits a plan. So when the contractor gives you a plan, this is what you should ask. Why did you select those methods? What tool configurations are going to be used? Are you going to be using one magnetometer sensor or two if you're using magnetics? Method to ensure data location accuracy, you're going to use GPS or have them surveyed in. What kind of deliverables will be provided? Are you going to present this in a way that I can understand it? And most importantly, since this is mostly for removal sites, we often go back to sites that are over 20 years old. So you always want to locate a telephone pole, a road intersection, or something to base your survey at, so if at a later date you can go back and reproduce the survey, that you'll have something to work from. So another thing that you could ask is how often you're going to dump data. You don't want somebody collecting data all day and then dumping it and finding out that some cable wasn't in all the way or some other thing wasn't operating and you just wasted the whole day collecting data. And another thing to add is background areas. Always test your stuff in instruments in a background area just to make sure it's operating correctly. If you see power lines like this and you have some targets underneath there, good luck, because it's going to be very hard in this type of environment to detect any object with all this EM radiation going on. So, and remember, small objects can be found, but probably only closer to the surface and not deeper. And masses can't be characterized. So you don't know if it's a refrigerator or engine block or two drums. So once you do find an anomaly, you don't know what it is until you actually dig it up. So we're down the home stretch now. They did a study in 1986, and I know somebody's going to be asking, why do we care about a study in 1986? Well, if you're working on a site that was started in 1986, this is pertinent to your site. 50% of the holes missed the plume, 30% were incorrectly placed, and 10% had unknown flow direction. So you want to make sure that when you're doing borehole geophysics that you're putting your screens and test equipment at the right elevation. So the other clue-in lecture about borehole, I'm put up the Don Bussey's information here. He's in clue-in, look under borehole geophysics, and his presentation will talk more about the higher-end tools. But for now, we're just going to be talking about natural gamma and video and connectivity. So natural gamma tool is great for looking for shales and clays. It can be used in any type hole, either metal, open hole, or cased plastic. So if you have a hole you don't know what the composition is, as far as if there's any shale in it, this tool will tell you. So you'll get a bump when there's shale, clays. Video, if you have a well screen, you don't know how much the interval is, or if it's all filled in with silt or clay, if you want to look and see if the sand pack is coming through the screen, or you have an open hole and you want to see if there's water in it or what the hole looks like. This is very bad drilling technique. Somebody was putting so much pressure on the tooling that it was bowing out the steel to hollow out the side of the wall. So video is pretty easy, pretty cheap to rent, and tells you a lot about the hole. Electromagnetic induction can tell you plumes and clays also, but the downside to this, it cannot be used in metal-cased wells. It can only be used in open hole or PVC-cased wells. So here's an example where we had a plume moving from the site. The RPM asked us to, we had a background, well, not a background well, but he put a well way out in front of the plume a couple of years in an area where he knew the plume would eventually go to, and allowed us to survey this over the years, and we did. So it was kind of interesting that he was kind of thinking ahead, because we actually have data where we can actually see where the plume went through. So sometime between 99 and 2000, the plume went past this well, and we were able to record that. So here's some examples from the well field over the years that I've seen at five-year reviews. This casing was actually cracked and probably due to the frost water freezing near surface. So this was just pulled out. Here's a site where the apron from the flush mount was crushed and allowed water to get into the well. We still have a lock on this well, but the hinge broke. Nested wells. I think these are just wells that were pushed in. The screen is probably at a very shallow depth, and one is missing a cap. Since this is up north in Michigan, a lot of snow plows up there in the winter, so that's probably what happened to this. We have an outer casing that kind of sunk in the annulus and is protruding with no cap. missing lock, faded ID, intercasing keys, to the point where this is immovable. Other intercasing keys. This one here was in a park, and I guess they didn't like, somebody should have put in a flush mount, but didn't, so they kind of made their own quote-unquote flush mount while here, and just left it as is. This one was in a school playground, so this was unlocked, and I opened this up, and there was popsicle sticks and other things that I pulled from here. So who knows what's at the bottom of it. Once again, missing locks. Somebody hit this one, a lock. This one was in a parking lot. It was actually plowed over pretty good. Somebody saw there was no lock here, so they put some wire on it as a lock. This outer casing was really loose, so I was just curious enough to see if I lifted this, what would happen, and the whole thing actually came out. So this is where it was when it was in the ground. It was the annulus was so destroyed that this was just laying in the well. So I don't know if these bumper posts were put in or out, in or before or after this was bent. Have a wasp nest in there. Not a very good pad right here. This one was one I haven't seen only once. The fence was actually stolen, I guess scrapped. And then the joys of working in the winter when you got flush mount wells, number one is try to find it, then number two is trying to get it open. And so there is a well here. This always begs the question, what's the best color to paint these things? White is good, except in the winter, but the well is actually there. If you can kind of, once you see it, you can kind of see it if I highlight it. So, any questions?
Thank you so very much, Jim. You were right on time there. That was well done. So we did have a few questions that came in, and I'll just remind the audience, if you haven't typed them into the Q&A window in the lower right corner, you can do so now. While we're waiting to see if any other questions come in, let me start with this particular question about mining sites. What tool would you suggest to investigate a collapsed mine to determine where water may be entering underground workings?
Well, that depends how deep the mine is. So the main problem is, besides the mine, is where the water is coming in. Am I getting that correct?
Yeah, again, they're trying to figure out where water is coming into that mine.
That would be a very difficult problem. Especially if it's in a mining area, because it could be coming in from other places. I'm having flashbacks to our agency mining issue in what town was that? It was somewhere around Durango, Silver King, I think.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another question. And this one is talking about forested areas. Are there or is there a particular tool you would suggest in a heavily wooded or forested area? They comment that the gradientized magnetic tool looked like it was projecting several feet around the person's body who was carrying it. And wouldn't that would be some sort of an impediment to them walking around in a forested area?
Yes, but if you kind of if you remember, there was a slide that I had walking through some weeds. I thought about pointing it out, and now I wish I did, because you can actually have those sensors above, in a backpack, above you, so from shoulder height and a meter past that. So if you're and I was doing that for the exact same reason. It was heavily weeded, so I just put it on a backpack and had the sensors vertically above me rather than on poles in front of me. So a gem would be a little bit trickier, but it is possible to have a gem in a heavily wooded area.
Okay. Okay. Another question. How much ground truth, for example, borings and logging, do you typically want for an interpretation of EM or GPR?
Well, that's why we use several confirmatory methods. So once we have an anomaly with one instrument, we'll usually use one or two others to have it. So we necessarily don't go to the point of putting in boreholes to confirm it, because usually the other two instruments can do that, but there is no problem with having boreholes to confirm geophysical answers.
Okay. And so another question just came in. You had mentioned some of the typical depths that some of these tools would work. Do you know what the maximum depth that seismic refraction would work on?
Well, the units for environmental purposes can usually go maybe 40 to 80 feet. To go beyond that, you'll need to get commercial grade, like oil field stuff, if you want to get deeper. So, because the sources that we use are just usually a hammer, or else there's a weight drop, which is a big, just a rubber band, a very big rubber band on a very heavy weight that slams it into the ground. So anything beyond that would be vibersized trucks, which oil companies have, and explosives. We used to have explosives, but they've encouraged us to get away from those, so we don't use those anymore.
Okay. Okay. Another comment or question that just came in here. One of the attendees mentioned that line cutting is routinely done for geophysics for mineral exploration. And they just went on to say that it could actually be done for environmental geophysics work. I don't know if you could comment on that.
Well, I mentioned that 76-acre site we did last month. That was actually a PRP site, and I actually did want to do that only with one of our backhoes that we had. And I was told that the PRP did not prefer us doing that to their property, so we didn't. So, those services are out there. That is a possibility if that's the route everybody agrees on.
Okay. Our next question, what kind of equipment might work inside a building that has, it's like a regular office sitting with a slab on grade? They're specifically looking for old tanks that were used in a manufactured gas plant.
GPR will work. And like I said, if there's no metal 15 feet above the instrument, EM61 would work. I think that's, well, and a gravimeter would also work.
Okay. All right, and now we'll move on to another type of site, and that's a saltwater plume. So one of the attendees wants to know if GPR is actually good for saltwater plumes or salt detection. They basically thought that was really more for EM or resistivity.
Yes. If you're looking for the barrier between freshwater and saltwater, that will work. But if it's all saltwater, the whole signal is going to be lost. But if it's pockets of salt water, you'd be able to detect those.
Okay. And what about UXOs? I mean, this might go a little bit beyond the scope today, but one of the attendees wanted to know if there were specific safety measures on sites where you might expect UXO or unexploded ordnance.
Yes, there's actually a department in the Army that specializes in that. Mines are getting so sophisticated that they're mostly plastic nowadays. There are special EMs that the manufacturer of our tools makes specifically for ordnance. So if you contact Geometrics or Geonics, they would be able to point you in the direction of specific tools looking for that. Obviously, that's very dangerous work, and some are susceptible to external fields. So even though you're not touching a mine, just having an electromagnetic field around it could set it off.
Okay. And let's take this one. And the participant, I think, hit home on one of the key concepts you were sharing with us today, is that there isn't just one tool that will work for all sites. They ask, is there a minimum collection of geophysical tools that you would suggest we keep on hand in order to be able to address most types of sites? I mean, does somebody need one of everything that you showed? Are there two or three that if they had, they could handle most of these sites?
Well, you can rent this stuff. I think there's only Atlanta and maybe another region that might have some instruments. We're kind of walking a fine line here because we don't want to be taking jobs out of our contractors' hands. So if we have a really big site, we usually leave that for contractors, and we use our instruments for checking up on PRPs, filling in spots that other contractors might have missed. So that's how we're using these tools. So, but if you want to start creating your own, it kind of depends on what you're seeing most in your region. You know, is it mostly buried drums? Is it mostly plumes? And I think that should drive what direction you want tools you want to buy. And they're not cheap, by the way. So, and they do. The magnetometer, for example, their sensors are designed to work between 8 and 10 years, and I found that to be true, that you know every 10 years the unit fails, so that's $16,000 to replace those. So it is costly to maintain these, too.
Okay. I think we'll just take two more questions here in the time that we have remaining. And this next one is actually more of sort of a carryover from the UXO and safety concerns question. And the participant here is just mentioning that there are a few concerns regarding UXO, EM61, and MAG are common. They say more recently there are other EM sensors that facilitate classification. So I don't know if you can expand or comment on that statement.
Well, we don't do UXO, so I mean, that's an entirely different geophysics all to itself. So other than that, I can't say anything else.
Okay. And then the last question that I'll take before we go through our final reminders today gets into, quite frankly, your materials. Some of the participants were just commenting on a lot of the detailed technical information that you had contained here. So where can they go for more information or to get a copy of the presentation material?
Well, I guess you're going to put it on Clue-In, correct?
That is correct. Yeah, we do have a copy available via PDF download if people would like to. And that actually leads me to our closing reminders where I will explain how everyone can access a copy if they are looking for a copy of these materials. Before I do that, Jim, any final thoughts you want to leave the audience with?
Well, since this is the first time I've done this, and I was worried that I might have presented too much stuff in too little time, so I'm kind of wanting to know how that, what everybody thought, and I would like to remind everybody that we do have 1, 2, and 3 day classes that will, in a much slower, quieter situation, describe all these methods. That and that, from what I understand, we have already have requests for 4 classes throughout the region next this fiscal year.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you. And with that, let me go ahead and just walk the audience through a few final reminders, including how they can access materials. I also want to thank you, Jim, so much for sharing your knowledge and your expertise with us during today's live broadcast. We did have over 140 individuals chime in from all over the country for today's live broadcast, and I'll just remind you all of a few items. If you like today's training or you want to find out about other webinars or technical resources, you are certainly welcome to visit us at cleanupinformation network, which is at cluin.org. We also send out a monthly newsletter on the first of each month called Tech Direct. You can sign up to find out about our webinars as soon as they're available. Copies of the presentation content are available as a PDF file. You'll find that on the seminar resources or homepage. And if you're looking for information about our organizers or presenters, you'll also find it on that seminar homepage. You can look under the related URLs page or box on the middle right and click the link of interest, then press the browse button to actually open that up on your own computer. And I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to share feedback for today's session. Exactly as Jim was just requesting, you can share your thoughts on both the mechanism and the mechanics of how we deliver today's talk, as well as the content that he shared. One of the most common requests that we get, if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our talks, while we don't necessarily issue those, we can offer you a certificate for joining us, and you'll obtain that after you fill out the online feedback form. Visit the link to the seminar feedback form, complete that form, making sure to check the box at the very bottom of the form certifying you are here for the entire session. Once you click that and you send in your submission, you should immediately have access to a certification file that you can either save or print out. We will also email it to you. If you happen to have participated in a group, each of you can fill out that feedback form link on your own and get your own certificate, regardless of whose registration you use to join us for today's broadcast. So, as I mentioned earlier at the start of today's session, our talk was recorded, and you'll be able to browse through the Cluin archives in about 1 week or so to access it. Jim highlighted other webinars that we have hosted as well. You'll be able to browse through that. If you have more questions about military munitions or dealing with UXO, we also have a variety of webinars that have been hosted by the Army Corps about that exact compound and how they address it at sites. So you're welcome to visit us or browse through the archive to replay those. So again, I want to thank each and every one of you for joining.